Baptist versus the City of Kankakee. Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. I also tried to make it cooler in here, and I was unsuccessful. So, the starting point for this case is the settlement agreement, or the agreed judgment order, in which the City of Kankakee agreed to pay $67,000 to the lawyer for the plaintiffs. It turns out that that lawyer wasn't entitled to that money. He had agreed to take the case for a percentage, for a retainer, for reimbursement of expenses, and for a percentage of the recovery. He had no claim in his agreement for statutory attorney's fees. He agreed just to take a percentage of the recovery. He was getting a windfall. And in papers that the lawyer filed, he said he was entitled to $52,000 out of that $67,000, and the rest he would give back to the plaintiffs. And, in fact, he actually gave some amount back, and it might have been more than what he said. The settlement, or the agreed judgment, doesn't give anything to the plaintiffs. It gives $67,000 to the lawyer. It gives nothing to the plaintiffs. It sets out that it's the goal of Kankakee to be non-discriminatory. Kankakee will appoint a committee. The committee can make recommendations. There'll be a non-discriminatory written test, or one that complies with the statute. But there's not going to be any reform to the issues that were to the claims that were at issue in the case. On September 12th, there was a court appearance where the district judge believed the case was settled, but it wasn't really settled because it was subject to approval by the City Council of Kankakee. So there wasn't mutuality. It was a proposed settlement that hadn't been agreed to or adopted by the municipality. The lawyers for this municipality said, I don't have authority to buy my client, but I think they'll vote on it. The next day, Mr. Brooks told his lawyer that you're not authorized to represent me because I don't like the settlement.
That's because he changed his mind?
I think he either changed his mind or he realized what was going on and realized that there was nothing there for him and there was money for the lawyer. The lawyer, instead of coming forward and telling the judge and his opponents that we have a settlement that hasn't yet been adopted by Kankakee, one of my clients has, I'm no longer authorized to agree to a settlement on his behalf, kept his mouth shut, agreed to entry of a judgment order, but the next day filed a motion saying, I need to withdraw because I can't represent this man anymore. Then within 10 days after that, after entry of the agreed judgment order, this Rule 59 motion was filed. This is a case where the district judge should have held an evidentiary hearing on the motion. He shouldn't have just said, well, I gave the plaintiffs a chance to speak up in court. They didn't speak up in court, so they're bound by it, even though at that setting, Kankakee wasn't bound by it. And something that we all lose sight of is that even for a police officer to speak up in court to a federal judge or to a state judge is hard to do. It's intimidating to be in court. But there should have been an evidentiary hearing. That's our argument. If there are questions, I'll answer them.
Not at this point.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Mr. Morris?
Good morning. If it pleases the court, Mr. Flaxman. My name is Stan Morris. I represent the City of Kankakee and Mike Kincaid, who is the police chief of Kankakee. First thing I want to do is respond to some of the broad statements this made by counsel. First of all, the first thing he mentioned was the money aspect of the settlement. He said that Mr. Bent, prior attorney for the plaintiffs, had a contract under which he was supposed to receive a certain percentage of any recovery. But the fact is that when the settlement agreement was made, the settlement agreement included the monies for Mr. Bent pursuant to the voluntary agreement. Apparently, the plaintiffs and their attorney at that point made some change in their compensation arrangement, as they were free to do. Now, the second thing that Mr. Flaxman said, he said the plaintiffs didn't get anything out of this case. That's just flat not true. And if the court will look at the agreed order mentioned by Mr. Flaxman, the agreed order of September 12th, there are several items that the plaintiffs received out of this case. Mr. Flaxman was asked if Mr. Brooks decided to change his counsel because he's changed his mind or because Mr. Flaxman said he realized what was going on. Well, the fact is that this is all, this entire proceeding here that we're here about today is because the plaintiffs changed their minds. The other thing that Mr. Flaxman suggested, he said that the court below was wrong by not having an evidentiary hearing on the Rule 59 motion. The first thing that gets involved there is the court below wasn't asked to have an evidentiary hearing on that evidence, on that motion. And the fact is that the local rules of the Central District require that counsel ask for an evidentiary hearing. You just don't automatically get it. And then with that evidentiary hearing, with the motion for the hearing, you've got to stay why you need it. That didn't happen below. So counsel, the court wasn't asked to do that. Now, this case is about buyer's remorse. On the day that the plaintiffs below agreed to the settlement, they were pleased with the settlement. On the next day, one of the plaintiffs apparently was displeased on the following day, and the remainder of the plaintiffs became displeased at some later date. The motion to amend or alter is really to present new evidence. That isn't what happened. The motion to alter or amend the judgment here was simply that they said they didn't understand. When Judge McCuskey, after hearing the terms of the settlement recited in open court on the day of trial, asked if that was the settlement that they had made, and they all answered, affirmatively. Mr. Flaxman said that these are police officers. They are not accustomed to speaking up to a federal judge. They all testified in a prior trial. They didn't have any problem. They were good witnesses. The entire terms of the settlement agreement were entered of record. The plaintiffs indicated affirmatively to the court when asked if that was their settlement. They answered by nodding affirmatively, and specifically Judge McCuskey said, I'm not going to take roll, but they're all nodding their heads in agreement. What has happened, as I said, they have changed their minds. And that just isn't a proper basis for setting aside a judgment, the judgment that was entered on September 12th. If that was a proper basis, there would be a lot of settlements set aside. Trial counsel would have a difficult time in trying to reach agreements if they kept changing because changes were brought. The plaintiffs were free to either pursue their case or to not pursue their case because they were certainly free to waive their remaining count, and the count we were in trial about to begin trial the morning of September 12th was a disparate impact claim. And they are certainly free to waive that claim as a part of a voluntary settlement. In addition, at the time the settlement agreement was reached, it was not in writing because the way it developed that morning. But, of course, a settlement agreement can be reached orally. It doesn't have to be in writing. But here the parties agreed to prepare an order, which would be an agreed judgment order, to reflect the settlement terms that were made of record. And that's exactly what happened. The three attorneys involved signed off, sent it to the court. The court entered the order. It fully reflected the oral settlement made on September 12th. The fundamental object here is to determine whether or not the settlement that the plaintiffs made on September 12th was knowing and voluntarily made. And it was. There had been negotiations with their attorney. And the vital thing is that the attorney that represented the plaintiffs was their chosen counsel. He was independent counsel. He was fully involved. Not like if we've got pro se plaintiffs. He was their chosen attorney and had been in the case for more than 2 years at that point. Whether the settlement was voluntarily and knowingly made is a question of fact, but Judge McCuskey below ruled that. He ruled on that question when he asked them in open court, them being the plaintiffs, if that was a settlement they made, and they said yes. The agreed judgment order was later entered. The trial court then had the ability and did make a judgment as to the credibility of those plaintiffs in their response affirmatively to his question if that was the settlement that was made. What has happened is that the plaintiffs at some point decided they wanted money in addition to the non-economic items that they agreed to in the settlement order. As I said before, the statement that they received nothing is just untrue because it's part of the agreed judgment order. The record reflects because the plaintiff's former attorney and their present attorney apparently got into a little bit of a dispute in some motion practice. The record reflects below that the former attorney, the plaintiff's, explained, and his words were in excruciating detail, how he explained the terms of the settlements to the plaintiffs and how they agreed to go forward. The plaintiffs, as the court knows, having read the briefs, the plaintiffs in part have attacked their former counsel. What they are doing is questioning his competency. Again, competency of counsel is not a proper inquiry in determining whether that settlement below was knowingly reached. And that comes out of a Riley versus American Family case ruled on by this circuit. And in fact, in the Riley case, counsel incorrectly explained to the attorney, to the client, the impact of a settlement. Nonetheless, the court went ahead and affirmed that and said, you've got to go ahead with the settlement, and if you've got a problem with your attorney, you take that up separately. And it is frankly advised of a malpractice case. Here, the same thing happens. Counsel was fully involved, their chosen counsel. The settlement was knowingly, voluntarily reached, and the only thing that happened is that they changed their mind. The plaintiffs want the totality of circumstances approach placed into effect here, and I submit that's not the case because under Pierce was a non-represented, excuse me. Any question?
Apparently not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
We're told that the question is whether the settlement was knowingly and voluntarily made, that that's a question of fact, and that the district judge determined that on September 12th when he asked everybody, do you agree to this? And nobody spoke up. That nobody speaking up really highlights what I'm talking about the intimidating fact of being in court. If when you're in court and a federal judge looks at you and says, you're nodding your head, yes, I see that. It takes a lot to say, no, judge, I'm not nodding my head no. Yes, I'm nodding my head no. You're lying.
That happens all the time, counsel.
It doesn't happen.
Mr. Flaxman, we ask jurors at the end of criminal cases, is this and was this your verdict? A very critical inquiry, and doesn't the district judge make a conclusion based on that?
Well, but they have to answer orally. We don't just say, okay, they all nodded their head yes when we polled the jury. We ask, Mr. Jones, is that your verdict then, and is that your verdict now? And you make them answer. That didn't happen to these people.
Mr. Flaxman, is your argument then that they're nodding their heads yes and the judge saying you're saying yes, they're all nodding their heads yes, they weren't? They should have been not going this way?
I don't know. It would have been much more prudent for the judge to say, do you agree to this now, just as he's polling a jury? It's only 5. It's not 12.
This reminds me of a plea agreement, and where defendants often want to get out of the plea agreement because they don't like
Well, if it's a plea agreement and it turns out that the lawyer was paid by the government to get his client to plead guilty, you would say, we got to vacate that plea agreement. That's what happened here. What we're told that the defendants, the plaintiffs and the lawyer changed their fee agreement.
That sounds to me like a different lawsuit.
It might eventually be, but right now it's before we're challenging.
If we were to set aside this kind of agreed in open court, where would it put us? I mean, Flom has already indicated we do this type of thing all the time and expect people to answer honestly.
We do this where we require people to answer. That didn't happen in this time. It also didn't happen that there was disclosure about the lawyer's self-dealing and unethical conduct. It is unethical when you have a contingent fee agreement to change the agreement to increase the amount of fees you're getting.
But in this context, the quality of the representation doesn't go to the question of the validity or enforceability settlement.
It should go to voluntariness. If the lawyer is doing self-dealing and is telling his client, you should accept if it's a good deal, when all he's thinking about is how he can pay his mortgage now because he's getting money he's not entitled to, that should be involuntary.
Well, the law is to the contrary, though.
I don't think it's to the contrary, but I think these legal questions should be decided on a factual record, not on our beliefs about what really happened.
I understand. I believe the point you're making about it wouldn't hurt to say Mr. A, Mr. B, Mr. C, Mr. D. Indeed, though it seems a long time ago when I took pleas, I tried to get an exchange as opposed to a nod from a criminal defendant. But in the setting of this case, with the duration of the case, with no indication to the trial judge, I'm assuming, of any self-dealing by the attorney, nothing apparent to him during the course of the however long the proceedings were. We have a setting where there is some time involved in the case. The judges, I assume it's been Judge McCuskey throughout, but I may be mistaken.
You're right.
I may be mistaken. He has 5 individuals and an attorney of record, and nothing seems askew. Other than what you're saying, there's a reluctance perhaps to speak up because as a layperson, you're somewhat chilled in a courtroom. If in that setting we're requiring an interrogation by the trial judge of each of those persons, presumably to unearth, are you comfortable with counsel as well as the agreement? That really places a heck of a burden, and as Judge Keeney says, it sets up a kind of inquiry that we in most settlements civilly we don't do.
That isn't what I'm asking for. What I'm asking for, the salutary rule would be like you poll the jury. Do you agree to that? Did you agree to that then? Do you agree to it now? And have them speak on the record, and the court reporter can write it down, not just an ambiguous head nod where you have to tell the judge you're lying, which I don't do when I'm confronted with that situation. I just walk out and wait for the next case. It's a very difficult to tell a judge that. You're making it up. You're misperceiving
counsel,
what I said.
As a legal matter, the judge didn't even need to get the nod of the head from the individual plaintiffs in this case. They can commit through their counsel to an oral settlement agreement. And so, you know, you're adding layer upon layer upon layer of procedural protection that just does not exist.
At the time that agreed judgment order was entered, which was not the 12th, was the 22nd, Mr. Brooks had told his lawyer, Mr. Bent, and Mr. Bent put this in the record the next day, that you're not
authorized. You're missing my point. The attorney could orally bind his clients in front of the judge, even in the absence of the judge soliciting the nod of the head from the individual plaintiffs. And that agreement was binding as of that moment.
But it can't be binding just on one party, Your Honor.
Sure it can. If there's consideration, if there's offer, if there's acceptance, then you've got a contract.
It can't be binding just on the plaintiffs, but not on the defendants. The defendants reserve the power to go to the city council and say, yes, we have a deal. And that wasn't on the 12th. That was specifically put in the record that we don't have a deal. I don't have authority to bind the city. The city council has to vote on it. And then when they did vote on it, it was after Mr. Brooks told his lawyer, you're not authorized to settle for me. And the lawyer just said on that, we didn't have a binding settlement with mutuality of obligation on the 12th.
Was that in the motion to amend or alter? Isn't that raised on appeal now?
It's raised on appeal.
Yeah, was that
mutuality?
That issue raised
I don't know.
I don't believe it was. I mean, do we have a waiver of that?
I'm out of time.
Well, no, I don't.
You're not getting off it.
I would say no, but you can't. You can waive factual issues. You can't waive the law. And I think there's even case law on that. But you can't, by not citing a case, you're not waiving the existence of that case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.